The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the Adrenals and Gonads is presented by Dr. John Sutton.
So first of all, we're going to talk about gonadal physiology and disease. So keep in mind that the gonadal axis involves the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the gonads. Feedback mechanisms are important. And keep in mind that without the production of the end organ products, the axis should respond. So I like to think of it as whether or not the gonadotropins are responding or not. So in gonadotropic hypogonadism, that you have elevated gonadotropins and low gonadal hormones classically. But in hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, you have low or inappropriately normal gonadotropins not responding to low gonadal hormones. 24-year-old male presents with a female body habitus, lack of secondary sexual characteristics, absent facial hair, infertility, small testicles, 10 or 1, elevated LH and FSH, low testosterone, normal prolactin. So you always want to know what the prolactin is in these scenarios. It's going to impact on what your final diagnosis is. Normal thyroid function. Pituitary is responding appropriately to an end organ hormonal deficiency. And that's hypergonadotropic hypogonadism, hyper-HYPER gonadotropic. So additional testing in this male patient would be, you may want to get a karyotype to make sure that this is not failure due to Klinefelter syndrome 47XXY. I didn't have, on any of my IM tests, I have not had karyotypes, but I did have them on my endocrine boards. So the reasons for hypergonadotropic hypogonadism: germ cell arrest, surgery or chemotherapy to the end organ gland, mumps, alcohol, immunity, intra-abdominal testicles also a fail, resulting in a pituitary response. If you have, on the other hand, I know we're internists and we're not routinely seeing children. So I used to see adult-sized children, but I don't see anybody under the age of 18. But 14-year-old male who presents with lack of secondary sexual characteristics and gynecomastia. So in this scenario, you do lab and the LH and FSH are low, total and bioavailable testosterone are low, prolactin is normal, thyroid is normal. Again, with these series of labs, you're trying to come to what's the baseline problem to be corrected. So low gonadotropins with low testosterone. This would be hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, but you may see this in a child who's not yet gone through puberty. So this is 14-year-olds definitely on the fence there. So delayed puberty, Kallmann syndrome is this scenario with a lack of sense of smell. You want to always ask about that. Hyperprolactinemia will suppress gonadotropins. Hemochromatosis or infiltrative disease can do it. Hypopituitarism, neoplasm in the brain or pituitary, anorexia or excessive exercise. So if fertility is in question, this patient would require provocative HCG or GnRH administration. For restoring male hormone levels without a concern for fertility, then we would routinely give testosterone. And the standard of care is definitely topical testosterone, although sometimes insurances require you to use injectable rather than topical. Topical is just smoother. Exogenous testosterone will suppress the axis and affect fertility, and some urologists suggest that you may want to think about that if you have a young man. I do say it in the beginning to them if they're young and potentially planning a future pregnancy, is that the testosterone will act like birth control. So, and it's possible that they won't necessarily come back as strongly once you stop it. So you have to have a big discussion about that. I did have one patient in Michigan that was able to conceive a pregnancy on testosterone. So, and that was a very unusual situation. So hyperprolactinemia, H-Y-P-E-R. Why would somebody have this? Pituitary neoplasm would be common, but any of your hypohypothyroid patients are potentially going to be hyperprolactinemic as well. So the baseline problem being hypothyroidism, you want to treat that first rather than the prolactin first. If they're not fasting, the prolactin can be higher, and different medications can do it. The treatment of hyperprolactinemia is medical. 44-year-old male presents with breast tenderness, decreased sex drive, breast enlargement, normal genital examination. Estradiol is low, testosterone is low, HCG, you want to know what that is, it's normal. Gonadotropins are normal, prolactin is elevated, thyroid function is normal. This patient has hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, but the problem is the prolactin. So always you want to go through, what are their gonadotropins? What is the end organ value? Is the prolactin high or not? High or not? And is the thyroid function abnormal? So the typically patients with hyperprolactinemia, that's a solo event, need to have an MRI of the pituitary to look for a pituitary in the brain to look for a lesion. Most of the time, if the lesion is related to how high the prolactin is, if there is one present, and the treatment is typically a dopamine agonist. Long-acting is cabergoline, short-acting is bromocriptine, and most endocrinologists routinely use only cabergoline. Rarely the patient needs pituitary surgery. Visual field testing could determine that there is a compressive lesion on the optic chiasm. If this is not seen on the MRI or CAT scan of the pituitary, then you don't need to be as concerned even if the tumor is large. So you want to ask the radiologist about optic chiasm compression. And even if there is visual field defect, these patients, if they're truly a hyperprolactinemia, the treatment is medical, typically not surgical. The differential diagnosis gynecomastia is that it is commonly in the elderly, the obese, and in puberty. Elderly is probably the one you don't think about as much. If you go to the beach, see all the men with their shirts off, you'll see that gynecomastia is common if you're overweight. And then in puberty, most endocrinologists have seen a number of peripubertal male patients who have breast development, and often you don't need to go further, but when I'm referred one of those patients, I always do the lab workup. High estradiol could represent testicular or adrenal neoplasm. High HCG suggests a testicular or pulmonary neoplasm. Generally, in these patients, you should do a genital examination as well to see if you can palpate any testicular lesions. And hypothyroidism. So if hypothyroidism is the reason, then the treatment is thyroid hormone, not cabergoline and MRI and these other factors. You want to act quickly so that you aren't missing something, but there is that is one of the classic presentations. So hypohypothyroidism promotes an increase in prolactin, suppression of gonadotropins, male hormone, infertility, and gynecomastia all wrapped up in the same patient. 16-year-old female presents with lack of secondary sex characteristics, no menses, which means primary amenorrhea. Primary amenorrhea refers to never having had a period. Secondary is having a period and then later it stops. That is not speaking to the pituitary in the mix. This patient has low estradiol, low LH and FSH. The diagnosis is hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism. Pituitary tumors, Kallmann syndrome with anosmia. So hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism, if they have a lack of sense of smell, that's referred to as Kallmann syndrome. Anorexia nervosa and excessive exercise both can do that. So you do get in a little bit of a bind in an Olympic level female athlete, for example, that is having a menstrual cycle issue because of the intensive exercise rather than excessive exercise. So in this same patient, the patient is short, the short stature. There's no genital secondary sex characteristic development. These patients have primary amenorrhea, no history of periods. And in this scenario, they might also have a webbing of their neck, infertility and those kinds of factors. This is hypergonadotrophic hypogonadism, known as Turner syndrome. So classically with hyper-HYPER gonadotropic hypogonadism, menopausal ovarian failure, surgical removal of the ovaries, or Turner syndrome where the ovaries are not functioning well based on the genetic abnormality. Based on abnormal karyotype. Secondary amenorrhea, so these are people that have a period and then stop having a period at some point. And that would be polycystic ovarian syndrome, where there's adequate estrogen, excessive androgen, uterine defects and trauma, such as from procedures, pregnancy, profound stress, systemic illness can all cause secondary amenorrhea. This is a patient of mine that I saw in the hospital in Nevada, and she has abnormal hair growth on her face. The key here was that she'd had it for 20 or 30 years and she was unconcerned about it. I did some work up on her, but her androgens were not elevated. So every doctor that saw her saw this, and every time they saw this, then an endocrinologist was on the case, and that was happening over years and years and years and years. You could potentially say that she doesn't need any workup, or you could work it up. But if you work it up, you're probably going to come up a little dry with a 20 or 30 year history. So hirsutism, you check. For hirsutism, a routine check should be DHEAS, total testosterone. I actually put on my order, parentheses, not DHEA, because a lot of labs will give you a DHEA instead of a DHEAS, and that's the wrong test. You should consider the possibility that there's an adrenal neoplasm if the DHEAS is up to twice normal, or if the total testosterone is greater than 200. Some say as the assays have gotten better, maybe if the total testosterone is greater than 150. And you should consider in hirsutism congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Cushing syndrome, virilizing tumors, or also part of PCO. I did have a patient in suburban Detroit who presented as an adult, 50-year-old man, looked phenotypically like a man, and as we got through his history and story, he was genetically female and had congenital adrenal hyperplasia that somehow hung on for a while, and then he developed adrenal crisis. In his case, he genetically was female, so his was hirsutism from congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Now I'm going on to disease of the adrenals. So the zona glomerulosa is made up of cells producing mineral corticoids, aldosterone, angiotensin II and renin regulation by sympathetic tone. High potassium will stimulate ACTH. Increase in aldosterone leads to salt and water retention. Increase in in angiotensin II leads to vasoconstriction. This is the well-known cartoon of that. Zona fasciculata and reticularis, from whence comes glucocorticoids, cortisol, androgen, DHEAS, and these are regulated by ACTH. So the steroidogenesis pathway is near and dear to most endocrinologists' heart, but when I teach it, I think it's not near and dear to most of the students. Baseline substrate for steroidogenesis is cholesterol. So the adrenal glands actually have, and other glands have LDL receptors to pull cholesterol out to make the steroids. The precursors are DHEAS and 17-hydroxyprogesterone, and the end products are estradiol, cortisol, aldosterone. That was the steroidogenesis pathway. I have not seen that on the boards, the actual pathway. 20-year-old female presents with weight loss, easy tanning, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, weak and dizzy, blood pressure 70 over 30, with a tan patient with confusion. This was such a patient that had presented to another office. She kind of had a funny looking tan. She had, without treatment, she had hypoHYPO-natremia, hyperHYPER-kalemia, hypoHYPO-glycemia, elevated BUN and creatinine, vitiligo. This is another patient with vitiligo, which is autoimmune skin disorder, and deficiency of all steroids. This was primary adrenal insufficiency. The significance of the vitiligo is that the adrenal insufficiency may not be as obvious, but if the patient also has vitiligo, you should connect that history with that case. So you can do on routine AM cortisol and ACTH. And most cases, you're going to need to do a cosentropin stimulation test, which is synthetic ACTH. This is given IV or IM, typically in a dose of 250 micrograms. Do a baseline value 30 minutes. Baseline value, give the injection, do a test at 30 and 60 minutes for cortisol. This is something that you can't routinely send to a random lab. I've had to set it in Michigan. We did it in the office. I've had to set it up at the hospital lab where I am to get them to do the right thing, even when the orders are pretty explicit. In fact, most labs say that you can't do it any time of day. You have to do it fasting in the AM. And of course, those patients do come into the ER at 7 p.m. and midnight and need to be tested at that point rather than wait until the morning, of course. If aldosterone, you can draw aldosterone as well. In this scenario, you can also, not only do you see a cortisol level that is blunted response, but you can see aldosterone level that is a blunted response. And what you're looking for on cortisol is greater than 18 to 20 above normal. Now, some of those values are going to be on the fence, and you're going to have to work with that patient over time to determine if they truly have adrenal insufficiency. So 80% of these patients have adrenalitis, autoimmune / idiopathic, and 20% are tuberculosis. In the early, in the middle days of HIV/AIDS, this became a bigger problem with tuberculosis, but still the autoimmune adrenalitis wins out. And then much less common, vascular, infectious, trauma, METs. I did have one patient in the hospital in Nevada who had who presented with adrenal mets of unknown source because he didn't have cancer before. But in his case, his adrenal glands were loaded with cancer. And in that scenario, they both have to be loaded with cancer. I do have a patient now, my only patient in 25 years in practice, who had a renal cell carcinoma that metastasized to one adrenal gland. They chose to remove that adrenal gland, and then it metastasized to the other adrenal gland, and they wanted to do that one as well. And so he was already seeing me for his thyroid, so he, of course, came back to me, and we do treat him for primary adrenal insufficiency, but his is due to both of his adrenal glands being removed because of the cancer. Autoimmune etiology is Addison disease or adrenalitis. You could consider testing adrenal antibodies, which we usually do. They're not always positive. And you should consider the fact that a patient with Hashimoto or vitiligo might fit into this category. It's not uncommon that Addison and hypohypothyroidism occur in the same patient. 50-year-old female presents with similar symptoms to this index patient, low to low normal blood pressure, fatigue, weakness, no change in skin color, COPD. So this patient presents with low sodium but a normal potassium, which is a clue to the source of the problem. This suggests, if the potassium is normal, it suggests that aldosterone is doing okay and the adrenal glands haven't completely failed. Low ACTH or inappropriately normal endo-organ value. You should be careful to with the timing of the stimulation testing, because sometimes I have had cases in which the blood for ACTH was drawn after ACTH was given. And if you're not real clear on when it was given, then it becomes invalid because, of course, you're giving ACTH. So it turns out this patient has a history of long-term steroid use, IV and oral, recent change in pharmacy, prednisone not renewed, presents with fever and lung infiltrates. Sorry. So this would be secondary adrenal insufficiency. The patient's on long-term steroids. The steroids don't get renewed. The patient doesn't make a case, and then the patient presents with some kind of a provocative event like a pneumonia. So these patients are typically steroid dependent, but also tumor, infection, radiation, surgery, trauma involving the hypothalamus or the pituitary can also be potential etiologies. Luckily, most of these patients do not have as profound of adrenal crisis, if they have it at all, as the primary adrenally insufficient patients. Physical findings: generalized abdominal tenderness, fever, and adrenal insufficiency, postural hypohypotension. You should look for some kind of precipitating factor. Sometimes you don't have to look for a precipitating factor because somebody else has not has missed the mark on the diagnosis. Pretty common, particularly in the ER, where they're busy seeing lots of more common disorders, and they may not recognize this. I had a patient in Michigan who presented with hyponatremia, hyperkalemia, marginal blood pressure, at least one other autoimmune disease, and she presented to a military hospital in Florida, and they didn't get it. And I had only the lab, when I saw her, I had only the lab that they had done, and they could not conclude the correct diagnosis. You want to be careful when you're seeing a patient for surgical abdomen, because these patients do have abdominal pain and don't necessarily have a surgical abdomen. And if there's any doubt, you want to treat them with steroids perioperatively if they do need some type of abdominal surgery. So surgery could precipitate an adrenal crisis. And so if there's any doubt, you put them on the steroids, proceed with surgery, and then back off and test them provocatively at a later date. Electrolyte imbalance is hypohyponatremia and hyperhyperkalemia in primary adrenal insufficiency. The typically hypotension, I tell patients that are in this situation and other doctors treating them, consider hypotension a potential adrenal crisis. And if there's no hyperkalemia, then this could be adrenal insufficiency, but not necessarily primary adrenal insufficiency, since the normal kalemia would suggest that aldosterone is intact. 80 to 95% of the patients will have hypoatropionatremia. Mineral corticoid deficiency results in sodium loss and volume depletion and increased vasopressin secretion due to loss of cortisol. Rarely, these patients can also have hypercalcemia. You can consider CAT scan of the adrenals for primary adrenal insufficiency. If you do this, typically primary AI will have small adrenal glands. MRI of the brain and pituitary for secondary adrenal insufficiency, unless the cause is evident. So when I have steroid-related adrenal insufficient patients that are secondary, I do not necessarily check their brain and pituitary by imaging. So in an adrenal crisis, IV hydrocortisone is usually used every 6 to 8 hours, 100 milligrams. You want to wean to a dose of about 25 milligrams daily in divided doses throughout the day, as hydrocortisone is rapid acting. Saline and glucose supportive, correcting support, other crisis-related events, and Florinef is aldosterone replacement and hydrocortisone is the cortisol replacement. If you give patients steroids for less than 30 days, typically you do not have to worry about the adrenal axis, and so you don't have to wean them. So if you do a two-week dose of high-dose prednisone that's only 2 weeks, then you don't have to worry about suppressing the adrenal axis and you don't have to wean the steroids. I tell patients for crisis intervention that if they're acutely ill, mildly sick at home, they should double their dose. And generally, they need IV steroids in the hospital if they're in the hospital or having surgery. And I tell them we are going to observe your sodium and potassium and your blood pressure. If they're periodically, you will have an adrenal insufficient patient that isn't hypotensive, but the hypotension is one of the main reasons to treat them. 25-year-old female presents with weight gain, hirsutism, diabetes, osteoporosis, centripetal obesity with acne and stria. This is a patient from suburban Detroit that had actually been on steroids but was off the steroids and had persistent stria. We did not prove that she did have Cushing syndrome because she had the stria, but she did not have an endogenous tumor. It was definitely exogenous. She had a little bit of facial hirsutism. She had that little divot behind her cheek, which is a little different than just the totally full facies from obesity, for example. That is Cushing syndrome. Hold on a second. I would suggest that you go over this graphic in particular. It tells you sort of what the cut points are, and you want to know what happens in a dexamethasone suppression test. I think that's an important piece of knowledge for your board study. Generally, to do a routine rule out, 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test. You give 1 milligrams of one milligram of dexamethasone at 11 p.m. and do a serum cortisol the next day at 8 a.m. You're shooting for a value of less than 1.8 to 2 for a complete rule out. You can also do a 24-hour urine-free cortisol. Late-night salivary cortisol is one possibility as well. These patients are going to have hypokalemia, typically, and hyper-HYPERglycemia may be present. There are some false positives, so you don't want to do serum cortisol testing, for example, on a patient on estrogen replacement or birth control pills that contain estrogen, because that raises the cortisol level and give you a false value. So if you want to test them serum-wise, you're going to have to take them off the birth control pills or off the estrogen and do the testing. These are stria from long ago pregnancy. The differential diagnosis, most of it is Cushing disease. So if you think you have Cushing syndrome, then it almost always is in the pituitary. And this is ACTH-dependent Cushing syndrome, but because it's in the pituitary, it's called Cushing disease. Exogenous steroids, of course, can do it. An adrenal lesion can do it much less commonly than the pituitary. And fairly common is ectopic production of ACTH from a lung tumor. This was a patient who had Cushing syndrome from exogenous steroids for a brain tumor. He also had abdominal stria. ACTH dependent is the pituitary or Cushing disease, and ACTH independent is adrenal disease. You're going to need to do clarification of the diagnosis outside of that original screen with dexamethasone suppression testing. Cushing imaging, Cushing disease, MRI of the pituitary, Cushing syndrome, CT or MRI of the adrenal glands, and ectopic, try to localize the source, which is commonly a lung tumor. Adrenal carcinoma is metastatic at diagnosis, presents typically in a very bad situation with weight loss, rapidly progressive, and it's typically excessive of all steroids in the steroidogenesis pathway, not typically insufficiency of the adrenals. 35-year-old female presents with hyper-HYPER tension, hypokalemia, thin patient, metabolic alkalosis. This is hyperaldosteronism, although the majority of patients that present with hyperaldosteronism have normal kalemia. So hypokalemia is a classic, but normal kalemia is the more common with uncontrolled hypertension, and you worry about patients who are young and shouldn't have hypertension or who are on more than three drugs for blood pressure. You do the biochemical workup first. Don't go straight for the, just like we said in the other lectures here, you don't go straight for the imaging. The classic is low renin, high aldosterone as primary. High renin, high aldosterone is secondary and is much more common with meds and other conditions. Elevated urine aldosterone on a low sodium diet off of diuretics is also a classic. And one way to prove it is saline suppression testing. If you load the patient with IV saline, their aldosterone should go down unless the aldosterone is autonomous. Hyperaldosteronism can be bilateral or unilateral, and generally we would do only medical therapy for bilateral disease. You want to try to localize the tumor to one side so that you can potentially take the tumor out. Secondary hyperaldo happens when you restrict sodium, when you have renal disease, high potassium intake, pregnancy, diuretics, those all cause secondary. Localization testing, the gold standard is adrenal venous sampling, although it is now said that if you can localize the tumor to one side and the other adrenal is completely normal on imaging, you might consider taking out the one with the tumor. My experience more recently is there's a lot of bilateral tumors, and you definitely don't want to take both sides out for hyperaldo or pheo. This was a patient of mine in Nevada that had adrenal venous sampling, and his localized to adrenal vein aldosterone of 16,000 on the left and on the right of 4 nanograms per deciliter. You do stimulation testing with cortisone at the same time to make sure that the catheter is in the adrenal vein. I'm just going to go a couple more slides here. Hypertension, unresponsive to medicine, a 40-year-old patient with normal electrolytes. Patient is thin, has a headache. Again, normal electrolytes doesn't exclude hyperaldo, but this scenario is palpitations, headache, diaphoresis, pheochromocytoma. Look for it a lot and find it almost never. Generally, check 24-hour urine testing for fractionated catecholamines, metanephrines, and VMA. The textbooks say you technically only have to do fractionated metanephrines. You want to do the urine testing off meds if possible. Sometimes some of the literature recommends serum testing, but if you look into the serum testing, which I think is not unreasonable, you can't send them to a routine laboratory. You have to do it in your office. So what the standards say for serum testing of catecholamines is they have to be lying quiet in a dark room with the door shut partially. The phlebotomist has to put in an indwelling cannula. You go in and try to take the sample without disturbing the patient. And I don't know about your office, but I don't think we can do that in most offices. And there's no lab that can do that. But either way, it is a profound value abnormality when you see it. It's not 20 points above normal. It's 20 times above normal for the urine or serum values. The classic test is MIBG. It's a nuclear tracer that goes straight for catecholamines. But MRI is, or CT can be done, although you on T1, T2 images, the signal is bright in a pheo on MRI. Alpha blockers are preferred. You want to avoid beta blockers until after the alpha blockers are on board. You want to make sure that if you're going to biopsy an adrenal gland lesion, that you don't stick a needle in a pheo. Now, the pheos are so uncommon that a lot of doctors get away with sticking a needle in an adrenal gland that because it's probably not a pheo, and they're assuming it's a met, which is the more common. But I suggest that you prove first that it's not a pheo. On the other hand, I've had only 5 to 6 patients in my entire 25-year career that were sent for adrenal surgery, three of which were pheos. So I've sent a lot of people for testing and almost nobody to surgery. This patient had a pheo on the right. This is an image with the feet facing towards you. This was an almost 10-centimeter pheo. And this was in surgery, and this was in the bucket afterwards. There he is before, and then that's his CAT scan after. This little dot at the end of the, on the lower left image, there's the adrenal gland, which is a little stem. It looks like it has a little cherry on it. This patient, this was not considered an incidental adenoma because she had breast cancer and they were looking for to see if it had spread. So technically, it was not an incidentaloma, and it probably was a met, much more common. There it is, the circle, the radiology circle sign. Incidental adrenal adenoma, benign adenomas are common. You should avoid imaging until you have the clear diagnosis. So you don't, again, in endocrinology for the most part, you don't think it's a pheo and check the MRI or CAT scan. You prove it's a pheo and then you go for the imaging. And they come to us a lot as endocrinologists in that in a reverse order there. Evaluation of these incidental lesions is more important if the patient's hypertensive, hypokalemic, or hirsute. So they're very common, but commonly not significant. Cancer patients, known cancer patients, 3/4 of these lesions are mets, and 2/3 are benign if there's no history of cancer. If there's no history of cancer and the laboratory is otherwise insignificant, we don't go looking for cancer because of an incidental adrenal lesion. Okay. Up to 20% may develop a functional component, so you might have to relook at their function down the line. And the bigger lesions are the more critical, particularly the more critical for change in function. The bigger lesions, greater than 5 centimeters, are the ones you have to worry about, might be adrenal cancer. function, surgical versus non-surgical resection, malignant versus benign. One of the important factors with adrenal incidentalomas, once you've proven that they're not FEO, if you choose to biopsy it, you can't diagnose adrenal cancer with an adrenal biopsy. So you can diagnose a metastatic lesion to the adrenal with an adrenal biopsy, but the adrenal biopsy will not tell you if it's adrenal cancer or not.